It was quite interesting listening to Fran and how they started We Buy Cars. No business plan, working on ratios, spending money on advertising. And, you know, I was quite struck by the similarity of how we started our business. Prentice 21 years ago, 25. Just to give you some background about our company, for those of you who don't know, I was a financial journalist for about 20 years. While I was at the Star, well, I started an investment club for the readers of the newspaper. I went to Harvey Tyson. I said, Harvey, I think this was 1985, 86, a lot of political uncertainty. And I said to Harvey, I think we must start doing personal finance more than heavy business on a Saturday. And he said, I don't think it'll work, but try it anyway. So I wrote a little article saying we're starting an investors club and we invite people to write letters and we will answer their questions in the paper the following week. That went out on a Saturday, and by Tuesday, security calls me and says, sir, there are three boxes here for you to collect. And I said, what are you talking about? So the guy comes up with three boxes of letters from readers. And we discovered and we realized instantaneously that this is a gold mine, that people wanted information on investments. And with the result, fast forward very quickly. Hello, Neil, welcome. Fast forward, we started this service to clients, and there was this huge, huge knowledge gap, and people were desperate to get information about investments, economy, and we had the same political uncertainty as we're having now. And we started Star Investors Club. We started having seminars. In fact, there was a gentleman today come to me and says, I used to come to your seminars 30 years ago. And strangely enough, I actually remember. It got so big, ladies and gentlemen, that I went to the editor of the Star and said, listen, there's a business here. So we actually decided to set up a business, and we call it Nain Pritchard Street Securities. We're supposed to get an office downstairs. And then the investors or the editors changed, and the new editor came in, and he said, no, that's a cuck idea. We're going to do something else. And I was in limbo. I already quit as editor of the personal finance section. And I said, no, I'm going to give it a go. So started my first business, as Fawn was saying, virtually no business plan, no money in the bank, just simple idea to give people good advice on their investments. Fast forward, I sold that business to Citadel many years ago. It was a bit of clash of cultures. And for a year or two, I was playing golf, and I met my lovely wife, Sue, and we were sitting there one night and said, what are we going to do? I said, let's start a business. And there was one guy from my previous company. We phoned him. We said, listen, come across. You want to come and join us? And I still remember we sat in the office there and we started a company. And now we were thinking about a name. And we tried to be very smart, and we Googled all these fancy names of Constellation Investments or Gladiator Investments. And then the idea came up. Harry Oppenheimer. What's the name of his house? It's called Little Brenthurst. Bing, and the light went on. I said, we're going to call it Brenthurst. Brenthurst, Joe Berg, Harry Oppenheimer, been driving past his house for years. So we started the company, and we actually Googled it. It wasn't registered. We registered the name Brenthurst as a financial services company. So we went out to town, and we started doing business. Within a week, I got a lawyer's letter, Mrs. Oppenheimer. Said, dear Mr. Haystack, you know what follows. Please change your name. It's part of the Brenthurst Foundation and Brenthurst family, and cease and desist. And I wrote her a very short letter, copying the registration, saying, ma'am, I'm not breaking any law. Either buy me out or go away. She obviously went away. There we are, three people starting a business. And we said, how are we going to do something different? And Fran referred to it. First of all, the two similarities between our two companies. One was starting small, virtually no business plan, but with an idea to give advice. How do we get clients? There was a book in my library called How to Get Business in 90 Days and Keep It Forever. That book is still on my desk, ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not. I met the lady, Wendy Evans, was a professor from an Australian university, and she did scientific research about product and human being. Why does a human being choose that product over that product? And it's a scientific treaty, and she actually met her. I took her out to dinner one night, and she explained that the human brain is programmed to remember name, date, place for about 90 days before it starts forgetting. Name of a person, name of a product, name of a meeting, what happened. So your brain is programmed to forget things after 90 days. And she wrote this best-selling book, How to Get Business and Keep It Forever in 90 Days. On that basis, we thought, our marketing must focus on this. And on the point of marketing, when we started, and I said, and Sue is our marketing director, everything you see that Brent is her stuff. I said, day one, what we make, 10% will go to marketing. And we've never changed that rule. Till today, what the income is, we spend 10% of our turnover on marketing for that simple fact. If you don't keep your name up there, keep it alive, people will forget you because there's company B, company C, company. In fact, in the financial services world, there are so many companies. So the second part of the equation was, and especially when we started and later on, how would we get people to call us instead of we calling them? We tried to change around their old age thing in the investment business, getting on a phone, Mr. Brown, come and talk to you, go to people, do a pitch and try and get some business. Very, very unscientific, waste of time, in our opinion. So we decided, let's use our journalism experience to get out to the public. And we write columns, get onto radio programs, and create a demand for what you do. And you do it as best you can based on just simply telling the truth. In fact, someone asked me the other day, explain your growth as a business as opposed to so many other companies. And we said it was actually quite easy. We had no business plan. We just thought, let's just tell the truth about the situation in South Africa and see what happens. And our clients really like that. They like the fact that we were not polishing the marble. Sorry, I do apologize. What happened 10 years ago? Interestingly enough, I was going to give you a long lecture about politics and economics. And 10 years ago, something else happened. In the budget of 2015, there was a smaller announcement in the budget that the Forex allowance has been pushed up for a single discretionary allowance from 400,000 to 1 million. And for the other application, you can take 10 million out. It wasn't discussed in the media. It kind of slipped in, and almost 2 days later, people realized, my golly, we can take a lot of money offshore. And I don't think the investment industry was prepared for what was to come. I'm not going to waste a lot of your time. I started writing articles, MoneyWeb, Newsweek, or New 24. I started writing about the situation in the country, and it wasn't a pretty picture. But the pushback from the media was fairly dramatic. I mean, I was slandered. I was an idiot, etc. I'm just going to stick with one or two charts before we get to the conclusion. The last 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, the thought occurred to me last night as 3 o'clock in the morning, I was still not sure what I was going to say today. And suddenly it struck me that we can thank the ANC for one thing. Apart from everything else that they've done, how they've ruined the economy, how they've ruined our budgets, how they've ruined our expenditure programs. There was one thing that they've done which has benefited all of us. And that was quite simply, whether it was part of a strategy, because nobody was expecting this in the budget 10 years ago. It just happened. They allowed South Africans to create global wealth on their own, with low administration issues, fairly easy. You could become a sovereign individual for most of your money, unless you were very, very wealthy people. You could physically actually take out most of your disposable cash if you so choose to do so. And we actually have to thank the fact that the ANC has allowed us to do that and still allows us to do that. Although they haven't changed the regulations over time, they are still in existence. And the benefit to those people who have taken advantage is quite enormous. But let me take a minute, just ask one question. In fact, I'm going to ask two questions. How many in this audience have semigrated from the northern parts of the country, mostly Joburg, down to the southern parts of the country, Cape Town, Mossel Bay, Hermanus? Put up your hand, give us an indication. A heck of a lot of people. Who in you in this audience has or have offshore investments in one way or the other? You just answered my survey. I took a chance. I was going out on a limb. You've all taken most of your money or some of your money. But at least the point I'm trying to make, you have the choice where to invest your money, whether you want to have it in South Africa or you want to take it elsewhere in the world. And I don't think that the local asset industry actually realized how big an issue this is going to become. After these articles started appearing, and I must add, there were other guys also saying the same thing, you could actually see the local asset management industry coming with a very defensive play. No, local is lekker. Things are good. JSC was the best performing stock market over many, many years ago. That was true. The JSC, up to 2010, ladies and gentlemen, together with Australia and America, were the three top performing stock markets in the world. And there's a good historical reason. If you understand history, you understand that we came with the gold mining boom, platinum boom, diamonds, and then we had that construction boom in the early 2000s with the 20 World 10. There were many, many driving forces in the economy that propelled our stock market to record highs. And for years, that was very true. And if you take a snapshot going 25 years ago from 2015, the JSC is still the top performing market in the world, believe it or not. Mainly because the first 6 years, two things happened. One is the offshore markets came off big time, the dot-com bubble. So they went into a negative phase. We were the beneficiaries of the Chinese commodities boom. And our stock market from 2001 to 2007 went up something like 400%. We were the darling of the world. So as a long-term race, we had a phenomenal race up ahead. But that all came to an end roughly 2009, 2010. And since then, from there on to now, the JSC has been a loser, hands down, against the rest of the world. And it doesn't matter what period of time you take, if it's 15 years, 12, 10, 7, 5, 3, 1. And there was a chart there we might find. And there's a chart that shows you over a 16-year period of time how badly our stock markets have performed. Let's see if we can get the next one. Here again, you have a 10-year figure. That just shows you how badly the JSC has done over a 10-year period. Starting point 10 years ago, 1 million rand invested. And you can see the various numbers there. JSC, about, what's it, 2.1, 2.2 million in your bank today, as opposed to up to 9 million in the NASDAQ, if you were. But just a very good global fund gave you more than double the JSC. So you can see what, thanks to the ANC, the gates were opened and people said, Sir, lady, you can take your money and put it anywhere in the world. No problem. People have done it in a very, very substantial way. And late last year, or early last year, when Mike Schuster was still alive, he was still doing some numbers for me. You reckon the number is much bigger than we think. And he spoke about 1.3, 1.4 billion, or sorry, trillion rand that has left the country. Investors who are making the choice to their benefit, and a lot of the people in the local asset management industry didn't like it. For simple reason, the product that they were selling was not what the public wanted. And today, fast forward, the numbers on the board is like a rugby game that looks at the scoreboard, as they say. That was the last 10 years. I'm making no predictions about the next 10 years. I'm just stating a simple fact. The other fact, if you might go on one slide, there you can see 10-year numbers. I'm not going to bore you to death with numbers. There's one chart I'd like you to see. Next one, please. Next one. Sorry, darling, I'm using none of your slides. This is an example of what I'm talking about. The local asset management industry in South Africa is under a lot of pressure. And it's very difficult to actually get the numbers, but this was in the latest Coronation. This is the dollar value of Coronation. Remember, it's not their money. It's their clients' money. Their business has actually shrunk by 30% in dollar terms over the last 10 years. The flows are negative, and this applies to most of the other companies. Sanlam, I'll get to Sanlam in a second. Old Mutual. Everybody is battling with the same problem. The clients don't want the product that they're selling more. They want offshore for various reasons and for very good reasons. Better returns, deemed safety, out of South Africa. And in fact, by taking your money offshore, it's your best revenge on the ANC's policies, because that will protect you and has protected you against the chaos in South Africa. And you have the returns to prove it. And I have many, many clients in our practice where, when we could take our 10 million, said, here's my 10 million, off it goes. Now, depending on the kind of risk factored, that decision has been life-changing for most of those people. I'll give you one classic example. And there were many cases where a guy walked in with 10, the current value is around about 100 million, being very aggressive. Those people are still in South Africa. And the thought that occurred last night is, were it not for the fact that South Africans, concerned about the country, can externalize some of their assets, has actually benefited the country enormously. And you think, in what way? In the simple way that those people might have emigrated in order to externalize their assets. Now you can remain in South Africa. You can migrate down from the north to the south. You can come and live in a wonderful place like Hermanus if you could afford it, if you had a better advisor. You can live in Cape Town. So those are the two trends that we've been seeing in the last 10 to 15 years in South Africa. The other trend is, of course, a lot of people are leaving. But I would guess, and I've got no factual stats to show it to you, a lot of people are staying in South Africa and have stayed in South Africa as a result of being able to move your money offshore. And I look at my practice, and I'm quite sure a lot of in this audience, and there are some financial advisors as well in this audience, I'm quite sure they tell the same story. By externalizing the assets, getting the growth that you could get offshore, I don't need to immigrate and leave the country. I can still enjoy this wonderful country. Live in the Cape, Winelands, Cape Town, Stellenbosch, Paul, Plettenberg Bay. But your assets are offshore. Fantastic. Thank you very much, ANC. Remember, we come from, and for those old-timers in the audience, when exchange control was introduced many, many years ago and very strictly applied, trust me, you would break the law if you went overseas and came back and didn't cash in your traveler's checks. There'll be a knock on the door, say, Volkskas has just phoned, say, you still got some uncashed traveler's checks. That's how bad it was in those days. So to a certain extent, this is one issue But the ANC have allowed people is to externalize their assets as they wish and where they wish. Fairly easy, still easy today. And the net effect is, in my opinion, being beneficial in two ways. People become richer and they're staying in South Africa. And that applies in my instance. And during the years that I was still writing stuff for MoneyWeb and then all the attacks you get on the bottom, why don't you bugger off and faith off or go off or whatever. I live here. All my children are here. All my grandkids are here. I do have investments offshore and I am very comfortable with that. So consider the ability to take money offshore as a huge plus. Where and when you invest and the timing, that is a different matter. It doesn't mean that offshore investing is risk-free. No, of course not. You've seen it again in the last couple of weeks. And every now and then you'll find some local fund manager saying, oh, now's the time to take money offshore. And there was one slide I wanted to show you where classic case of Old Mutual in 2018 going around the country saying, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange will be the best stock market going forward for the next 5 years. I mean, it was absolute rubbish. And they were pushing this message out to their agents and their planners. And if you look at the end result, is actually quite shocking. And there's a reason for that. This is the bread and butter. This is the high fee products that they can sell in South Africa. The minute you take your money offshore, you can get much better returns at lower costs and greater choice. I mean, today, you're a global investor. You're a sovereign individual. I always get so annoyed when I see the stock market reports on Netrack 24, on News 24, and it focuses solely on the local stock market. And I've often written to the editors, and I say, guys, most of your clients have got most of their money offshore. Give them offshore news. And they just don't get it. You've just proven most of your money is offshore. You're interested more in the behavior of the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or the Stocks 50 or the Euronext than the local JSE. Your money has been externalized. So that was the thought that came up last night. We actually thanked the ANC for this, that you still have the ability to take money offshore as and when, and you're fortunate enough to take it. The negative thing is, of course, they haven't adjusted these allowances since 10 years. 10 years, $1 million Rand would buy you $84,000. Today, due to currency weakening, you can buy approximately $52,000. So the same million Rand hasn't been moved up, and this is becoming a problem for certain people like myself, who has a daughter who is in London. $1 million doesn't go far anymore. It buys you less and less. So they've left it where it was. So the best investment strategy of the last 10 years is to take your single discretion allowance offshore every time you qualify for it and build a nest egg. That has been a fantastic strategy. You don't need $1 million. It can be 100, it can be 500, but make use of it while it still exists. And if you're fortunate enough to have larger amounts of money, the same process, you apply, go through the tax clearance. Remember, it's legal money. It's legal to have offshore money. It's not being unpatriotic having offshore money. Everybody has done it. In fact, there's one more. I'm not going to show you how they stuffed up the government. Now I'm really going to spoil your day. All right. There was an article 2 weeks ago in MoneyWeb written by, I think it's Arden Krier, an Ips journalist colleague of mine. And he basically said, the big money has left the JSE 10 years ago. And that was quite a statement to make for a media publication that has been very cool, if I could put it, on writing about offshore investments. Actually admitted the big money has gone. And there's a reason. But again, why? And this pertains to my advice when you take your money offshore. My advice to consider offshore as the main building block of your wealth is not simply based on short-term political movements up or down the rand. You've got so much more choice in terms of investing. From the moment you wake up, you're in the Japanese stock market, which, by the way, That's been a phenomenal place to be. But whenever have you read any article about the Japanese stock market in the South African media? I mean, the Orbis Global, Japan Global Equity Fund has been growing like, top of my head, 12, 13% in dollar terms for 10 years. Quietly chugging away. It's been a phenomenal investment. You can invest in India. You can invest in Europe now. If you want to benefit from the rearmament taking place in Europe after Trump's tantrums and stuff that he's doing, then buy some European companies, European defense companies. They've been doing fantastic stuff. Yet our media is so focused on the local companies. They're all suffering from the same restraints. The economy is in the slump. It's like fishing in a fish pond versus someone who's fishing in the open sea. In the open sea, you catch these big bluefin tunas that make you the blots of money. The South African market, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, and this is a fact, it's not I'm making this up, has been shrinking as an investment pool as a result of the destructive policies by the ANC for many, many years, but it's becoming very, very acute. You heard from WeWay Cars, one of the very few listings in the last couple of years that got the public excited, but our universe of companies was shrinking all the time. And therefore, when you analyze the returns of the South African equity type of funds or even multi-asset, they all give you the same kind of returns. There's very, very few companies who can shoot out the lights. Why? Because they're all fishing in the same pond. Pond is very, very small. The big pond is out there. And I don't think that... So the gates have been opened. And unless government, and there is pressure, there was a comment 2 weeks ago by a politician in one of the newspapers saying, maybe we should pull back on these very generous offshore allowances as a way to keep more money in South Africa. And that's been repeated quite often. Unless that has changed, that should be your priority of building a broad-based global portfolio. If you want to stay in South Africa, if you want to live in South Africa, it doesn't matter. You're building global wealth for, and that simply is the story that we've been telling to our clients. And to end off on one last point, someone this morning tweeted about, don't you invest anything in South Africa? I said, we've been investing billions in South Africa. Our bond market has been a phenomenal place for risk-averse investors looking for a predictable return on their money. But that's not the money-spinning funds, ladies and gentlemen. There's a low-cost funds, but bond funds, global enhanced, very big bond, enhanced income funds, by merging the two and having a 70-30 mixture, 70% offshore equity, 30% bonds, enhanced income funds, have actually been a phenomenal formula to follow the last 10 years, giving you returns of about 14% per annum over 10 years at very low volatility. And that's the kind of strategies you can create for clients if the universe is your canvas. So that's what we've been doing for our clients. So thank you for your time, and thanks for the slides, Bronwyn. Send me the book.
Let's go straight to audience.
Hi, Mr. Haystack. Brandon here. I was just wondering what your thought process and decision-making process is with regards to integrating digital assets into clients' portfolios, and if you have thought about including this for your clients' products.
Sorry, I can't hear a word. Very simple question. Very simple answer. And, you know, I've been asked this question a lot of times. Why don't you recommend Bitcoin or digital assets? Quite simply, whatever my views are on this is simple. Until about 18 months ago, it was not legal in terms of our license requirements to offer that kind of advice. And secondly, I haven't written the exam in order to qualify to give the advice. Some of my other members have in the staff. Remember, we are a team of 23, 24 financial advisors. Some of them all of them much younger than me. They can recommend it if they wish to do so. We have a very open culture in our company, very flat structure. There's no boss telling them you have to invest there. And it's one of the reasons why it's such a nice company, very flat structure. So to answer your question, I've just told young Max here, I'm actually enrolled at the University of Cape Town doing their Bitcoin and blockchain course. So call me 8 weeks from now, okay? So I cannot legally advise a client in a professional relationship to invest in Bitcoin. I'll be breaking our regulations. In general, I can make a comment and say, it seems to be that there is a place for Bitcoin in your array of funds, and maybe 5% monopoly money or gambling money, or call it what you like, smoke and drinks money. Is it part of a structure? Yes, it seems to be gaining an acceptance, but it comes with a high degree of volatility like we've seen in the last 2 weeks again. If you're prepared to live with that, it's fine. But can I professionally advise? No. Generally, yes. It's becoming mainstream.
Question there?
How do you, as a financial advisor, decide to allocate a client's money? You have options from Polish real estate to Parmesan wheels to cryptocurrencies. What systems do you use to guide yourself in making an asset allocation decision? And how do you decide when to sell and when to buy an asset? And just to follow on, why do you think the ANC let people take money out of the country in 2014?
That actually is a very good question, the second one. The first one is easy. We got our clue from The Wolves of Wall Street. Did you see that movie? We sell anything. No, we don't. No, we don't. You know, let's explain to you how we make a choice in the business. Obviously, we are inundated with people wanting to ask to sell their funds to our clients. So we have a team of people who listen to submissions, and we have a guy like Tony Bell, who runs the very successfully the Raging Bull winner for 10 years now. We use him as a consultant, and we have created let's call it a menu of funds in various risk categories that we have spoken to the fund manager. We've looked at their systems, we've looked at their ownership structure, and a whole lot of stuff. And then we answer the question, can we safely invest money in this particular fund? And it's a whole process. And 70% of approaches to us are rejected. And that started many years ago when we had guys like ShareNet, ShareMax, and LeaderGuard and Bitvest coming knocking on the door that you want to sell this to your clients. It's such a lot of commission. But of course, that out the door. I mean, they all flopped. I mean, I can't tell you how many guys have knocked on our door. And when they use the word commission, they're out the door. So we have a screening process with consultants to tell us these are the good funds and you can use them. And out of that, that's the best we can do. We scale it down to about 60 or 70 funds. And from there on, it's the decision of the individual advisor, because that person has a relationship with a client. And then we use econometrics measures to gauge tolerance to risk, and then we max the fund with a personality. So it's a whole process before you get to a portfolio. The second question is, I don't know. I don't think they realized what they were doing. Maybe they wanted to take some money out themselves. It's always been, why did the ANC do this? But they created a total new industry for ourselves. And I'll explain what I mean by that. 10 years ago, when we sit in front of a client, it was 90% local assets, local funds, local trusts. In 10 years, based on that, all the money is gone. And we've seen it in our practice, in our business, across the country. I would say about 60 to 70% of our money is offshore. If the parents have not gone with their money, most of them have stayed, believe it or not. It's the children who have gone. Yanni's in Perth and Sonny's in Portland. Suddenly we have to give global advice, global trusts, global tax, CITES tax. We had to reinvent ourselves as a company to give that kind of advice. People walk in today and they want advice on their trust, the endowment structures, inheritance, and a lot of people don't understand it. Most financial advisors need to understand they are now global advisors and they have to upskill themselves very, very dramatically. And we've seen it also with the asset management industry. I just wanted to mention Sanlam. There's a very interesting point. Look, When the movement out of the country started with money, a lot of the asset management companies initially resisted it. But as time went on, they started forming relationships with the big players overseas. Standard Bank with JP Morgan, Discovery with Goldman Sachs, et cetera, because that's what the clients wanted. Very interesting announcement 4 months ago. Sunlop, of all companies, said the following: we don't want to do active management anymore. We want to do a deal with 91. They must take it. Quietly under the radar, they basically said, we don't know how to manage global money. Give it to 91, who left South Africa a long time ago, or enter the global markets in 1998 when they bought Rick Bedina's flight and started their global funds and exchange. These are share exchange. And I thought this was the most fascinating transaction, that Sunlop, probably the biggest or second biggest, said, someone else must do it. We don't know how to do it. So it's quite a nice topic for you to share. So Hendrik de Tooy always had this vision of building 91, or before that, Investec Asset Management, into a global player. And that took 30 years, but it's working for them now. They're now the biggest. So local managers are saying, we actually don't have to run global funds. Let someone else do it. So that's an interesting development. And it's just part of the bigger development of South Africans externalizing their assets in a legal way. And nowadays, it's a very friendly environment. So the onshore-offshore debate is over. It's gone. It's dead. It's buried. There'll be times when some South African funds do well. They'll outperform for a short period of time. But there's no driving force of the JSC really that can compete with the best of the best out there.
Thanks, Magnus. Curious on your views on China as a investment destination. And if I could ask for one more question, if you had the liberty to give your clients your house view, what would that asset allocation look like by geography?
All right, that's a very smart. Right now, because of the downturn of the Chinese markets for the last 4 years, China offers very, very attractive valuations. If, and always a proviso, when it comes to Chinese investments, what is the government going to do? There seems to be a reapproachment of governments and business sector in Japan. I started buying things like Alibaba 2-3 months ago. That's gone from $80 to $120. So there's already some early buying in China for people to understand the risk. And there are some nice China funds either here or offshore. And that, considering there might be, remember the last 15 years it's been USA, USA, USA. It's just sucked up all the money in the world. It's not only our market complaining about money flowing out. The Brits are saying the same thing. The Australians are saying the same thing. All the money's just been sucked up by this period of American exceptionalism. They call it Magnificent Sevens, just sucking up and growing bigger. There is fear that you might be near the top. You never know, but the signs are there. So some of the smart money has been moving out of the US into Europe and also into Japan and also into Japan and into China. So yes, I would be allocating some money to China for the right time. That was the second question. Asset allocation. 70% still in the USA, maybe dropping that a little bit. I was looking, and we run funds offshoring. Sean Pichet is talking tomorrow, and I actually sat next to Sean at breakfast this morning, and I was looking at the returns of his fund. In this last 2 to 3 weeks where markets are tumbling, Sean's fund has actually gone up to record highs. And I looked at his asset allocation. He has been quietly moving away from America, and he was buying British and some European stocks, exactly what I was talking about. Sean picked it up. So I actually had to congratulate him. So clients in there have actually made money in, because these are the trends. And that's why we like using different kind of managers with different kind of investment style. But we have to know what they did. I have a very, very strict instruction to any fund manager that we use. If I call him or her, they must take the call. I'm saying, Sean, what are you doing now? And then you must take the call. So we need to know what they're doing.
Just to follow on to that question, there's a high concentration of wealth in the developed world with a very small number of shares at ridiculously high valuations. What's your view on the fact that we might be in for a crash and some of the value investors have already moved lots of their money into cash and gold?
I'm going to be very careful. Yes, of course, markets are going to crash. I just don't know when. Let's be very serious. Markets are expensive. Overseas markets, US market is very expensive. Warren Buffett has been signaling for quite a while, I'm happy in cash. The central bank buying of gold has been increasing all over the world. Gold itself is starting to improve as a countermeasure to these high valuations. The problem is these high valuations can go even higher. You just cannot call the highs. However, it does make prudent sense to start cutting or reducing your exposure away from the US market and selectively. If you look at the top fund in our company is run by Tony Babbitt, the IP Global Opportunity Fund. And I was talking to Tony last week. I said, Tony, you're 20%. No, that's about a month ago. 20% in cash. There's an example of what managers can do behind the scenes as opposed to an index. Now, he can, and he said to me, I don't like markets. The red lights are starting to go on. I'm 20% in cash. And I said, Tony, I'm with you. Now, if you look at the performances then, he's on a relative basis done very well. For anybody to try and predict major crashes in front of 200 people is ludicrous. Yes, markets do crash. If you don't have the stomach for big, big drawdowns, you should not be in the stock. You should be in the bond market or the income market. It comes without saying. You don't go and run a marathon and after 5Ks you say you're tired. You must know it's part of the game. Maybe not a good example, but we educate our clients on drawdowns. We say it's going to happen. These are the worst ones. These are the bad ones. If you're not happy with that, do we look for something else? And that's just part of the advisory game. So do I think there's a crash coming? I really don't know. Do I think it's time to be more aggressive on gold? Yes. I like gold, like Japan. And the other day someone asked me, if the whole world collapses, where would you put your money? I said, I'd probably put it in the Swiss franc or the Danish krona as a safe haven. And that's based purely on the stability of the country, the stability of the Reserve Bank, and the level of reserve. But that's really, really kind of doomsday stuff. Markets find a way of adjusting themselves. And that's normally what happens.
Magnus, yeah, thanks. My question would be more coming back home.
Sorry.
Yeah. Coming back home in terms of our service providers. So we're sitting with the likes of Allan Gray, 91, Old Mutual International, Sanlam International. They are all there. Which of these platforms, obviously we use them to funnel the funds offshore, would you think or suggest maybe is the better ones in terms of admin? And in terms of offering funds as well as a sort of a private wealth capacity, you know, buying into share portfolios.
Yeah, that's win-win. And I need to go back about 12 years ago in our personal history. I came back from an investment tour in the United States with Investec Asset Management at the time. And we went to Tesla, we went to Google, Facebook, Amazon, and it was called that coffee company, I don't know what's the name, Starbucks. So we went and visited all these companies and met with these guys. And I came back to South Africa and I said, gosh, we need to get in this technology boom. And in South Africa, I couldn't find anything. There was one tiny little technology company, Stanley Bader, and they actually just closed it. They said there was no demand for technology stuff. I then started phoning around the platforms that you're talking about. The platforms are the vehicles that would put our offshore funds. And some guys don't even take the call. We spoke to Glacier. And we went to that Sutra Momentum. Someone at Momentum listened to our call and I said, my question was the following. I said, I want technology funds. I want demographic funds. I want healthcare funds. And I want biotechnology funds. Can you help us? They were very, very helpful. And they went and organized with Vanguard and Templeton and those guys to put them on the fund for us. So we have a very good relationship with Momentum, and we still have it today. They said, whatever you want, we give it to you. So it was a demand-driven solution that they gave to us. Dacia is very good, but from personal experience of all of the ones that I deal with, Momentum is by far the best. And if you want a new fund, they'll listen. So, right, we'll put it on for you. And on the Momentum platform, for instance, I can buy physical gold. I can buy those shares. I can buy Bitcoin. So there are other platforms which you can only deal with three or four, because otherwise it becomes too complex. So to answer your question, we prefer Momentum on the global side.
I just want to see if there are any questions in that side or on that side of the room. Thank you very much. And then I'm going to take the last 5 minutes with you, Magnus, if you don't mind.
Paul.
Magnus, you talk about the foreign direct investment allowance. If people are using an arbitrage investment, you can use that allowance up very quickly. So you might only send 500,000 offshore, but you might do it 20 times in a year, and you've already used your allowance up, your 10 million. Surely that allowance should work in a way that if you send money offshore and then you bring it back, it should be cancelled out and you should be able to send more. Is that not a fault in how that allowance is calculated?
You know, the way they calculate the allowances will be changing all the time. For instance, I'm going to get to your question. The other day I found out that even my Netflix subscription nowadays, or anything that I pay for in rands to dollars, Adobe, Netflix, Pornhub, all those services. It comes off your allowance. And somewhere there's this big machine sucking up all this information. The VACs are talking to each other. And I got a letter the other day and say, yes, sir, your allowance has been exceeded. Stop using your credit card. So there are guys watching us what we do. So I don't think it'd be clever having three different credit cards or bank accounts. It can come back to bite you. And I've heard the issue is that if you bring money back, it's not recorded to offset what you've taken out. So yes, it's probably, but that's the thing that Treasury Reserve Bank needs to look at. But they're becoming a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? Very cracking down on people. For instance, I refer to my daughter in London with her credit card paying for stuff. And they also stopped her and no more. She's over her limit. So the million rand today doesn't buy as much as it could 10 years ago. And my fear is someone might just convince Treasury has just cut to no more offshore. But just by not adjusting it for inflation-adjusted terms and dollar terms, it's getting less and less and less. So that's why when I see a new client, I say, how much have you taken offshore? Let's use your million rand and start creating an offshore portfolio. And that has been a very good strategy. Client's comfortable, the returns have been good, and you're in control of the money.
So, Magnus, I'm going to reverse engineer our introduction, because not many of you heard me when I was introducing Magnus Haystack, the founder of Brainthurst Wealth. People were transitioning from the room. Brainthurst Wealth is 21 years old today. I think on this stage, we celebrated your 20th birthday last year. And Brainthurst Wealth has been voted the top performing boutique wealth manager for 7 years in a row. That was started by Intellidex. I know Intellidex is now merged, but it's still a fundamental base case test in South Africa. And then further, Daily Investor has just voted Brainthurst Wealth the most trusted boutique wealth manager. I just wanted to sweeten you up before I asked you a really tough question. We're sitting with a situation right now. I mean, Magnus, we've sat on many stages together. You've always been proved right in terms of your view of offshore over South Africa. And I think fundamentally, you can see what's happening right now. Although we did hear Faan talk about the positivity in the broader economy as well. But the foreign policy issue is looming large across the board. And I want to understand how it changes the standpoint, because you congratulated the ANC on making it possible for us to invest offshore, right? But with sanctions looming, and I don't want to be a dramatist here, but potentially if worst-case scenario unfolds and we did see the sanctioning of South African government debt, what would that mean for us in South Africa?
It's something we don't hope doesn't happen, but it looks like it's going to happen. I think that the ANC is not getting, they're not reading the room. They're not listening to clever guys, Joel Pollack, telling them, guys, you better change your position on Iran and then Israel or else. I think one of the previous speakers mentioned the very, very strong Jewish lobby in Capitol Hill. You cannot ignore that. They control substantial amounts of money. And the one way to punish South Africa for that anti-Israel stance is to by cutting off the financial lifeline. I mean, our bonds are bought all over the world. And if they place an embargo on the sale of our bonds to Americans or American institutions, IMF, World Bank, who knows? It could be very catastrophic for our financial situation. And it'll come in two ways. I've been thinking about it a lot. First of all, your currency will take a big knock. If the currency takes a knock, your interest rates on your bond blow out, so there's a massive loss, and it's quite catastrophic in the extreme if it happens. So one must pray and hope it doesn't happen. Ramaphosa comes to his senses and talks to Donald Trump and at least makes some concessions. Start dealing with the man. Don't send him the middle finger. We don't need you. We're not going to supply you with the rare earths, metals, you know, that kind of rubbish statements. Don't talk to the biggest guy in town. They will come after you. And it looks like we are on his radar. He surrounded himself with Elon Musk, and he's very, very well informed about South Africa. He's been playing golf with Gary Player for 30, 40 years. Gary is really outspoken about South Africa. When I used to play golf, with Gary a couple of times. His friends were Ernie Els. So he's been very well informed as to what's going on. They try and mock him. He's an idiot and doesn't read books. I don't believe that. We must be very, very careful. So to answer your question, it will have a severe impact on South African financial markets, whether your bonds or equities or, and then you are looking for more protection in Bitcoin, gold, offshore assets. So that is something that everybody in this room must pay very strict attention to. And you'll see the markets start reacting as we get closer.
Last year, on the same stage, we were chatting about the elections and the government of national unity prevailed and there was positivity post the election. We're obviously seeing a situation now where the budget wasn't tabled. Hopefully it has been now. But many are saying that that's great. That's a celebration of democracy. It is a coalition government working. I didn't think I would ever ask you this because generally you are pessimistic on South Africa, but are you more pessimistic now than you were when we chatted about the elections? Which obviously there was that, as I said, some positivity post the election, but it looks as though your negativity could be proving right.
I'm going to make it very, very clear. People say, are you anti-South Africa? I'm saying no, I'm anti-ANC. Very different. I have been buying properties in South Africa since we spoke, believe it or not.
In the Western Cape.
How did you know?
Oh. It's my research. What can I say?
I was nearly tempted to buy something in Johannesburg the other day. Ladies and gentlemen, just to give you an example of what's happening in this country. Office block in Tiger Valley, 32,000 rand a square meter. Same office block in a nice area. The same building, same type of construction, 17,000 rand a square meter. There's a misallocation at this point in time. Now, there's a slight recovery in the management of Johannesburg. And now that Ramaphosa has evolved, I've got full confidence it's going to happen. Johannesburg must be so cheap. Right now, rand for rand. And the Cape, to my mind, is getting very, very dangerous. I mean, the prices people are asking for land, I'm just saying this smells like a bubble. It looks like a little bit of a bubble. So I'm saying, opas, might be time to look at Joburg again and some estates because they are so cheap. This is an example. So my negativity is driven by ANC policy. And the ANC have introduced expropriation the medical health insurance, the Better Act and other acts coming. So I think my temperature has gone up a little bit, worried about the economic structure and the damage that the ANC is doing. And we won't pay the price. It's our children will pay the price. All children. We see it already in the levels of unemployment of young black people not getting jobs. That is a scary statistic. And that's what worries, keeps me up at par.
I want to close out. You said earlier, if you were to choose two currencies, we talk about them as hard currencies to put your money in, it would be the Swiss franc, well understood. The Danish krone, just some thinking around there, and excuse my ignorance.
Well, if you look at Denmark with you know, their foreign exchange reserves is like 200-300% of GDP. It's an astonishing number because of the oil, the sovereign oil funds that have been building up and their sound fiscal policies over many, many years. Denmark has got mountains of money. If you want a currency that will at least buy and retain its value, you need to look at some Danish krone. And Switzerland, of course, historically has just been a very safe place to be. But that, I mean, look at Denmark with Novo Nordisk and those kind of companies that they're putting out into the world. It's a little country that really impresses me.
Thank you so much, Magnus Haystack, Brainhurst Wealth.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence. Renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise, our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.